today I'm here with Charlie Schrem, who is the CEO and founder of BitInstant, which is a Bitcoin company. Charlie, thanks and welcome to my little program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So can you tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from and all of that stuff?
Sure. My name is Charlie. I'm born and raised in First Incorporated in Brooklyn, New York. I started getting involved in the Bitcoin space in early 2011 when it was still fairly new. The first ever Bitcoin post by Satoshi was in November 1st, 2008, but it didn't really get any attention until somewhere around late 2009. Sometime around 2010 was when the first Bitcoin exchanges and companies started popping up. And I was one of the first, I would say, startups in the Bitcoin space. Our company, BitInstant, allows people to buy and sell Bitcoin local locations all over the world.
And you're fairly young, right?
I am 23.
And did you grow up in New York?
Yeah, I grew up in New York. I went to high school here in Brooklyn. Then I went to Brooklyn College. My first freshman year of Brooklyn College, I started a startup. I realized like early on that I was self-diagnosed myself as psychologically unemployable. So I said I gotta figure out a way to make money in the world, and the startup space seemed like the best idea. So when I went into college, my cousin came to me with a cool idea. Dailycheckout.com was the name of the site, and essentially what we would do is be a deal of the day site where we'd sell one product every day. Well, not one physical one, but like one product and thousands of pieces of it, hopefully, we'd sell. And then by doing that, instead of having to like buy 10 cameras a month from a distributor, we'd be able to buy a few thousand a day. And then that gave us a lot of purchasing power and give good discounts to our customers. And it was a little novel idea. This was before Groupon, which kind of like took on the daily deal bubble. We ran for about 3 years in college under Platinum Capital Growth. It was really good because I was very young, 18, 19, and I was able to make a lot of mistakes on other people's money, the investors. But at the same time, I was able to learn from those mistakes at a really young age, and I felt like that was the best educational experience I had. And I was still in college at the time. When I started it, our office was in Brooklyn, like really, really close to school. So it was very easy. I was able to go to school during the day and back and forth from the office. It wasn't difficult, but kind of like a year into it, the president of Platinum Capital decided that he's moving all of, he owned like 15 websites at the time. It's about 100 people, 100 employees. He said, I'm moving, kind of like an accelerator setup. He said, I'm moving everyone over to New Jersey. So like he moved us closer to the Pennsylvania border than even in Brooklyn. It's about an hour and a half commute in traffic each way every day. And I had to start going to night school because I was already 2 years into school and I wasn't going to quit. And that was fairly difficult for me. I had to make a lot of sacrifices to do that. But at the same time, like, I didn't want to quit school because I was just in it so long and I felt like it would be such a waste if I had left. I wasn't learning anything. I still barely learned. I have a degree in economics, but it's like, it's Keynesian economics, so it's the complete opposite of what I believe in now in Austrian economics and Bitcoin. But I guess I needed to learn the other side before I can see the light. And then thankfully, by my early in the fourth year of college, we got a great offer to sell Daily Checkout, and it was really fun. So I was able to have some time off, like finish up school.
Was it a good sale?
Yeah, it was really good.
So you made some good money and then had some time off and figure out what's next?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like crazy millions or anything, but for a 20-year-old kid, the money that I came into was, I felt like I was a super millionaire already.
Right.
And I live with my parents, I have no bills, it was nothing. I didn't have to like pay for anything except for my car. So that was pretty cool, and it was good to see that like after 3 years of like slaving, to finally get some like some reward. But at the same time, the experience and the knowledge and like the everything, all that was just like amazing. It was the best best 3 years of my life. I had so much fun doing it, and I really miss all the people that I worked with. But at the same time, like, so I had that, and then just one day, I think like a few weeks right after the sale, I was just reading, or it was even during possibly like the end of daily checkout days, I was just browsing on the internet forums.
I read this somewhere. You started reading about Bitcoin, and then you like became obsessed. And did you buy Bitcoin when you started doing that?
Yeah, so I became obsessed, and I started to buy some Bitcoin. It took about 2 weeks to buy Bitcoin. And Mt. Gox, like their wire got frozen. Trade Hill's bank account got closed. It was a big hassle.
And it still does. I'm trying to get into Bitcoin now, and it's still. I mean, I'm probably 3 weeks still waiting.
It's ridiculous. Well, you won't have to use them anymore in a few weeks. I mean, right now Mt. Gox's failure is really giving the opportunity for someone else to step up to the plate, and a lot of good exchanges are about to launch or just have launched. So, don't worry for long. So
Bitcoin right now is trading at $138 per Bitcoin. What did you started buying then? Like, what did you get in at?
It was like $5, $10, $13,
oh, really?
Then back down to $5, and then back up to like 7. Remember when it hit like 17, and then 23, and then 35. It was just crazy.
So you made money on your first on your business, and then you've made money again on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Nice. You're in a great position.
I wish I had bought more. Life could be a lot different now, but I mean, everyone does. I put all of the money that I have and had into BitInstant in the beginning because when I was browsing online, I came up with this post. You know, I said to myself, if this thing is going to succeed, there needs to be like an easier way to get money in and out of the system, like a lot easier. And so I was just browsing on the Bitcoin Talk forums, and I saw this post by this guy, Gareth Nelson, who said, I have this great idea to make, and he was calling it Fast Mt. Gox Pay. And this was his idea. He's a 21-year-old autistic fellow who has Asperger's living in northern UK. And he came up with this idea for BitInstant. And I emailed him and I said, here's $1,000. This is a lot of the money that I have. And let's do this project. Until today, like 2 years later, we have 15 people on our team. I still never met him.
You still haven't met your co-founder?
No, I never met him. It's really, really funny.
And so he's over in the UK, is he?
Yeah, he's over in the UK. We're really, really close. We've become close over the year and over the past 2 years, and I was supposed to go to London last week to meet him, actually. And he was like kind of, he didn't want to meet me. He's just like, it's going to be so weird because we know each other so closely. And it's like this internet presence, and now we're going to like meet in real life. Like, he's a little kind of nervous about it, but that's who he is. He's a very big advocate for like people who have autism, like can be high functioning, he can do really well, and he's a math genius. His code never needs QA testing; it just always works. Mm. He's a genius. He's an unbelievable guy, and I'm so happy that I was able to come into his lap in a way. So that's how we started BitInstant, and that was like 2 years ago. And it was such a joke back then. Bitcoin, it still is. If you look at what like Gandhi said, how first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, and then they fight you, and then you win. I had thought that we were at the laughing stage 2 years ago because I was being laughed at by everyone. But I realized that actually we were still in the ignoring stage, and now we're in the laughing stage. Now it's just like we have the world spotlight on us. And the news, the press, the media, yeah, they love it. They love to cover it because it's fun, it's interesting. But at the end of the day, like, they really don't understand its utility and really how it works and what change it will bring to the world, and only time will tell. And Bitcoin is just raw infrastructure, and it takes whoever can really harness that and develop it into a mainstream product, which is what I'm trying to do. But I mean, yeah, I had to put $1,000 on myself, and then I went like 2 months later, we needed more money, and no one would give it to me, like no one. Everyone, so I ended up being my dad wouldn't even give me the money. My mom gave me $10,000 to start the company, like to continue it. And then I tried to go raise a seed round, and that was like, oh my god, you have no idea. Every VC in Manhattan laughed me out the door. And it's funny because like they'll call me back now, just begging for a lunch or begging to invest, and I'll just like I never want their investment because I'm great now, but I'll send them a ridiculously bad term sheet just to see if they entertain the idea. But I was trying to raise just like $100,000.
Just be careful. You're on top now, but it can change. I mean, I pick on VCs more than a lot of people, but you know, you never know where things are going
to
go.
I'm not like trying to pick on anyone, you know. But at the end of the day, it's like, I don't know. I feel like VCs are very two-faced in a way.
Well, they're trying to make money, but yeah. Anyway, let's go on. So you've got your co-founder. He came up with the idea. You found it on a forums. You're helping fund him with some stuff. So you're here in New York. Is this, you have 15 people?
Yep.
And so they're all based in an office here in Manhattan?
No, we're mostly in Manhattan, about 80%. We have some of our developers in Seattle, and our director of business development is over in Japan, and then we have some team members down in Panama City.
We're all over the place doing the distributed thing.
Yeah, the other stuff was kind of just location based. Most people are moving to New York or have moved. Panama was the strategic move. We have a lot of relationships in South America, and I decided to open up a satellite office down there.
And so, why don't you tell us about the idea for BitInstant? I mean, I guess we kind of alluded to the problem a little bit in that you talked about it used to take 2 weeks to get onto Mt. Gox, which is the central Bitcoin exchange. I've opened up my account there, and it's still not, you know, validated. Probably 3 weeks later. BitInstant's doing something totally different. So why don't you tell us how that works?
So there are two types of Bitcoin customers. There's the under $10,000 customer and there's the over $10,000 customer. Anyone who wants to buy over $10,000 worth of Bitcoins, there are specific reasons. You need really like high quality know your customer and AML policies, which is why you're going through this crazy verification. But most people, I would say like 80% of people buying Bitcoin don't care to buy one, on an exchange, and two, don't need to go through all of that rigorous KYC, the postal and all that stuff, to do it. So I said, let's develop a way to do it where we're not treating every customer like a criminal. We're still satisfying KYC and compliance, and let's see where we can take this. And we actually registered with FinCEN like back in earlier 2011, developed a KYC program way before any Bitcoin company was like doing that. We were the first ones to do it. So what you see right now is kind of BitInstant version one. We've never changed our site in 2 years. I would say like 60% of our customers are using our API, not even coming to our website, or they're using our services that are integrated into one of the app. But what you see now is just buying Bitcoin. We've really conquered the market share and buying low amounts of Bitcoin. Using BitInstant, you can go into like any Walmart, 7-Eleven, CVS, Duane Reade, Walgreens, Walmart. I already said Walmart, Wallbounds, Albertsons, and you can buy Bitcoin at these locations. We've made partnerships, so we're essentially using their register. You would come to BitInstant.com, create an account with us. Say I want to buy $400 worth of Bitcoin. It would pull up a map. You type in your zip code, find your nearest location, print out a deposit slip, bring it to the teller, hand the cash and the slip to the teller, and that's it.
So I've tried to buy Bitcoin through BitInstant using Dwolla, and it didn't work. And I tried a lot of times.
What do you mean it didn't work?
I go to your site. I give in my information through Dwolla, and then it was like the site was broken or something. The screen would refresh or something, and then it just wouldn't go through.
When was this?
2 to 3 weeks ago, and so that's when I gave up and went to Mt. Gox.
So it's right now Dwolla is disabled on our site. Dwolla like API has been broken for a few months. So the way we've had to do it is kind of like scrape the basically their API doesn't give a callback when a payment is processed. So we've had to like scrape the statements to see if a person actually made a payment, and if they changed one pixel or if they changed one word on the statement page, the whole thing would fail. So like 80% of orders are just failing all the time, and it was a big problem. So finally, like last week, I got Dwolla to upgrade their API. I guess we were doing enough volume for them to actually notice us. But now we're like one of their top 10 merchants, so they'll do whatever I want. So that should be back up in a day or two, and it'll be automated. I'm very excited about that. But what you see now is really, we've been working on a lot of projects under the radar. We've kept very quiet. We haven't changed anything on the website, any new launches of any new products. But soon, very, very soon, you'll see a total rebrand of BitInstant.
Cool. Have you guys raised money?
Yeah, a lot.
And so your model basically works where you want to speed it up for the process for people to get money, and so you actually advance the money out of pocket and then get paid later and somehow know that then that what you're getting is good. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
How does that work? How do you not get ripped off?
We assess risk. We do get ripped off sometimes. But it's all mathematical formulas at the end of the day. It's part of the stuff that Gareth developed. And we work with partners that are reputable, that are going to give us good funds, and they're going to work with us. And I mean, look, it's very simple for you have a store like Walmart. They like working with us because I'm just sending customers into their stores. I'm sending thousands of customers a day into their stores. It's so easy for them. Now people they're checking out. They make a transaction fee. They literally have to do nothing. And so I doubt they're going to rip me off. They want to keep that partnership. We do have to. The big issue is liquidity, because we're buying so many Bitcoins every day on behalf of our customers. Mt. Gox has just proven to be like a complete and utter failure in their infrastructure, and they're one of the reasons that Bitcoin will, like, not if it not will, but if something does happen to Bitcoin, it's a good chance it's Mt. Gox's fault, because they just can't handle things.
Yet they are the best exchange out there. I mean,
they're not the best at all.
There's a lot of others that have tried to do what Mt. Gox has been able to do. And
well, it's a chicken and the egg problem. It's just about liquidity. It's where you have it's whoever has liquidity. So you can have the crappiest exchange like Mt. Gox that is built in PHP and was set up as a playing card exchange. That's what Mt. Gox stands for, Magic the Gathering Online Exchange.
Right.
And it's just because he has all liquidity. He's been around for the longest. So it's a big chicken and the egg problem. You really need an exchange to have a lot of liquidity for people to actually move over there. So again, like, I think that I know that's being worked on, and people have some very creative ideas to get liquidity.
I mean, yeah, they're dealing with a hard problem. How are the margins for a site like Mt. Gox? I mean, are they making good margins or are they not?
He's charging a transaction fee, and he charges less on the more volume you do. So I know, well, I don't know for sure, but I've been told by a few people that they don't actually sell their Bitcoins. They hold on to it. So assuming that they've kept all of those Bitcoins they got from trading fees for the past 2 years, then they're doing pretty well.
Interesting. So he could actually be. So he's not making profits. He's saving because he's confident that Bitcoin's going to continue to go up.
And he probably sells a little bit to cover like cash flow stuff, operations. But overall, this is what I'm told. They make a smaller transaction fee, but they keep all the Bitcoin.
And so, but this is also holding back the growth of Bitcoin in general.
It's a big issue. It's a very, very big issue. Mt. Gox, I mean, CoinLab is trying to fix that by buying half of Mt. Gox and moving it to America. But we'll see how that actually works out.
You don't think it'll work?
Well, I just know Mark, the CEO of Mt. Gox, and he is very, very reluctant to give up any control whatsoever. Like, the big problem with Mt. Gox is that, like, even though he has 10 developers, he's the only one who could push code out, and he's the only one who can make actual changes. So, like, when they get hacked, it's like, if he's sleeping, all right, that's it. The whole Bitcoin world is waiting for him to wake up right now. And there's, like, a joke. When Mt. Gox goes down, it's like Mark tripped over the power cable. So it's a really big problem that you have one person who has so much control over Bitcoin.
I love the internet world. These are the odd things that always happen, and it's what keeps it interesting.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, other than that, Mark is a really, really nice guy.
So you're effectively, like, if we didn't have these sorts of problems with Mt. Gox, and we wouldn't maybe need BitInstant. You're helping solve this speed problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not Mt. Gox would have problems, a lot, most people, most customers who are buying Bitcoin don't want to actually have to put dollars on an exchange, enter a trade order, and then wait for it to be filled. They want to just be able to give money and buy Bitcoin.
Right. That's all I want to do, and it's, exactly. It's such a hassle.
So we make that easy. It's a simple setup.
And how much Bitcoin can someone buy through BitInstant?
Right now we have a flat daily limit of $2,000 per day, at $500 per transfer. But we do have velocity checks, so if you're doing like the limit for 3 days straight, then things will get frozen. We outline a lot of this stuff in our KYC manual. But overall, not as many as you think, not as many customers as you think would try to divert the system. Mostly people are following the rules here.
I mean, I just personally, I need something simple to pay people with, and I'd like to start using Bitcoin, and I haven't been able to. You know, I need to be able to pull maybe $1,000 a month out of, in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there are so many good uses of Bitcoin and great utility, but the infrastructure just isn't there yet.
Right.
People come on and people come like new into the space now, and they say, oh, this is so difficult, blah blah blah. And on one side, I totally agree with them. Like it's still really bad. But don't forget, I'm coming into this from 2 years ago, and what Bitcoin was then and what Bitcoin is now, it looks like Rome on steroids.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just a lot of edge cases that have to be fixed. I mean, the most important thing is that it's continuing to work, and even with all these issues, then it works, and so. We don't know if it'll continue to work or not, but hopefully it will. And even if this version of Bitcoin breaks, I think the cat's out of the bag now. We know that this model is real, and so we'll have another model of Bitcoin if this one does break somehow.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a big deal. I know how big a deal it is. I see people talking about Google Glass, and I don't understand why they're wasting their time. Like, to me, Bitcoin's where things are interesting.
I don't know. I like Google Glass idea. I just don't know how mainstream it'll become because I think the biggest problem with it, and I was playing with it, is that you have to actually talk to the Google Glass, like, out loud. So there are, like, a lot of cases where it's just, like, super inappropriate to use it.
Yeah, I mean, I like to see things get a little bit of validation first, because it's too easy to get on stuff at the wrong time. And it's being overhyped, in my opinion, from Silicon Valley. So I don't trust it until I see a lot of sales and people really happy with it.
There's this great product that I ordered like 3 months ago, and it's coming out in July. It's called the Leap Motion. Have you heard of it?
No.
It's basically this like little box, the size of like two iPhones that you put. It goes in between like your body and your keyboard. So you're sitting at your desk, and basically, it creates a 3D space, and you can control your computer, and your mouse. Just with your head.
Okay.
Like Minority Report.
I saw an armband version of something like that, and I thought that. That seemed more interesting than Google Glass too. That wouldn't surprise me if those do a lot better. But anyway, let's stay back on Bitcoin because that's
sure.
that's the topic of this call. So, as I started learning about Bitcoin, one of the interesting revelations for me was that Bitcoin is actually a peer-to-peer network. It's a peer-to-peer ledger, which is hugely boring but incredibly fascinating. You want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Bitcoin is the largest supercomputer in the world, because what Bitcoin allows for is this like computing power of everyone in the world to put all of their resources together and to be able to be a part of the infrastructure. When you have a credit card, every single transaction goes through a central transaction server. So, for example, if you take the Visa network, for example, a few months ago, or a few weeks ago, actually, two months ago, the Visa data center in Canada, in Vancouver, went down. There was a power surge. I don't really know what happened, but there was like 6 hours when the whole place just lost power. And because of that, for those 6 hours, no one in Canada can use their Visa credit card because there is one central point of failure and there's one database that's saying, all right, debit Charlie's card. Credit Adrian's card. And that's so what Bitcoin is that Satoshi took a hammer and he broke it and he put all the pieces of the database on everyone's computers that is using Bitcoin. So it's like you have this like completely distributed database, supercomputer, and in order to hack Bitcoin or to take it down, you'd literally need to like DOS or hack into every single computer of that's has a copy of the database. And anyone who downloads the Bitcoin program has the database with every single transaction up until the most recent transaction. And then when Bitcoin miners are actually, they're not mining, what they are is they're auditing transactions, and they're broadcasting it to every single database around the world. So on one side you have this database, right? But the other side you have this huge worldwide pool of computing power that's all working on this one thing. And because and that gives the Bitcoin network its power to broadcast everything to the net to all the databases across the world. But at the same time, it makes it really, really, really hard for someone to try to double spend counterfeit Bitcoin, because you'd need a supercomputer larger than that of the whole Bitcoin network combined.
We don't know for certain that I mean, there's going to be some vulnerabilities, I would imagine, that will come up. I think there have been in the past. It's just how serious they are and if we can manage them. But I got to say, I mean, Bitcoin survived a couple of years without any serious issues. So.
Well, this is the thing. This is, and I just had a conversation with someone about this the other day, because he's like losing sleep over it. And I said, you have to understand, Bitcoin is not like, it's not like software that becomes battle tested, and that only a select few of developers see the software and then they put it out to market and they wait for the hackers to come in. Bitcoin is completely open source. Every single line of code, every single period, every single exclamation point, semicolon can be seen by every single person in the world. So that means you have worldwide genius hackers constantly trying to hack into Bitcoin. And on the other side, you have world-famous cryptographers, mathematicians, statisticians, and developers that are constantly working to make Bitcoin better.
Right.
So I think that it's extremely preemptive in that, like, if
and there's
they
a,
find...
There's, I mean, the market cap of Bitcoin right now is like $1.5 billion. So, you know, there's a real incentive to crack that, and that hasn't been done yet is amazing. And
if you can hack into Bitcoin, it uses the same security algorithms that banks use. So if you can hack into Bitcoin, you could hack into any bank account in the world. The only difference is that the banking software, only a few people can see, and it's not as organic as Bitcoin. So if there's a problem, like with SHA-256, which Bitcoin uses now as the hashing algorithm, what will happen is Bitcoin can just update. And it can update itself if a vulnerability is found somewhere along the way. Even if a 51% attack happened and someone had a supercomputer that's then larger than the network, the system would only take about 3 confirmations for it to correct itself and make the difficulty higher.
Who distributes the updates? That comes out of the Bitcoin Foundation?
No. So the Bitcoin Foundation is not doesn't have any real power over Bitcoin and how it works. Essentially, there is a core developer team, and the core developer team is just the de facto they're the de facto developers for any updates, because they are the ones who worked with Satoshi and have been in contact with him. And it's really hard to become a core developer today. But in theory, anyone can post an update to Bitcoin. It's just who is willing to accept it. So if the core dev team posts an update, they need everyone to accept it and to update. So, but most people will, because they trust the core developer team, and you can read the code and they're not being malicious. But really, anyone could be involved in updating the code, reading the code, and the miners are the first ones that need to accept an update, because when they're mining, they need to all be mining on the same protocol to prevent a Bitcoin fork, which is what almost happened a few weeks ago.
Do you want to tell us what happened?
So I don't understand fully, super deep into what happened, but essentially they released an update of Bitcoin QT 0.08 and from 0.07, and there was a bug in 0.08 that didn't allow for a larger block size over a certain limit. So what happened was, one night, a few days after the update came out, there was a block of transactions larger than Bitcoin 0.07 would allow. Larger than Bitcoin 0.08 would allow. So the the program automatically rejected the block. And all these miners started rejecting these blocks, all of these transactions. And it caused a Bitcoin fork. It caused a fork in the blockchain, because what was happening was the system thought that these were rogue blocks or 51% attack. And so they were allowing the 0.07 guys to publish the new blocks. And then the 0.08 guys were also publishing their own blocks, but different ones. So it caused like a fork, but they ended up working out. They stopped the 0.08 block. They reverted everything back, and it all came together really, really nicely.
I'm sure there'd be more little adventures like that.
Of course. I remember when it happened, like, I was at a bar mitzvah or something, and I got a text, like, emergency, and I ran out. And I was like, where are you going? And I said, the Bitcoin blockchain is forking. No one had any idea what I was saying.
So, for your personal, you still have Bitcoin. Do you have, like, where do you store them?
So I have a ring that has a private key on it, like engraved. Mm-hmm. So I have that. I have a few physical coins. And then I have some super secret systems of cold storage that I have.
Hmm. So you actually have physical Bitcoins. You can buy those with actual, so they have the code on them that you can then spend.
Mm-hmm. Mike Caldwell makes them. His website is like cosatius.com. Don't ask me how to spell it because I don't. But if you type in physical Bitcoins into Google, you see them. They're really, really nice. They're great gifts. He makes silver ones, gold ones, 25 Bitcoins on them. They're really fun, novel things. Really cool guy. Cool people.
And so what kind of transaction volume are you guys seeing through BitInstant now?
We're processing in the seven figures. And we're
per month.
Per month, yeah. And within about 3-4 months, we're gonna be processing in the eight figures per month.
Really?
Yeah.
You're seeing that much growth?
Yeah, it's been crazy the past 4 or 5 months especially. But we've been on a steady growth rate, like 30% every month.
Hmm. And how much issues have you had with fraud? I mean, Max Levchin always talked about when he was at PayPal, he spent all his time tackling fraud. Is that what you guys spent a lot of time on?
In the beginning, yeah. In the beginning, we had a lot of fraud. TradeHill, the other exchange, closed down because of it. But we quickly figured out how to combat that, how to mitigate the risk, and I'm really thankful to say that we've had such rare cases of fraud, I can name them to you, in the past 6 months. We barely deal with it anymore.
How much do you think you lost to fraud?
I would say somewhere in the $50,000 to $60,000 range.
Oh, well, so basically you've had no losses, given that you're doing $1 million a month now, and that's going to go to $10 million a month. You guys have done a really good job with it.
Thanks.
I mean, I think at PayPal, it actually threatened to shut them under. They were having so many problems with it. So I think their problems would have been several orders of magnitudes.
It's, well, thankfully, like, good experience comes from bad judgment, and enough people have made bad mistakes and fixed them in the fraud space that we can learn from it. Hmm. So I can't really take much credit for that. I have to thank everyone who lost a lot of money on fraud
before you
for our success.
And was that something that Gareth helped a lot with?
Yeah, he did. He did. He developed really good velocity checks. The folks over at Dawala and I worked together really nicely to get a lot of the fraud away. They helped a lot on their end. We helped a lot on our end. Just having low limits and slowly trusting a customer as he does more business with you really helps in terms of fraud, because you're not going to get that one-off guy who wants to come and just do a chargeback or shut you down.
But you don't seem to have logins. So it seems like your page is like login free. Like, how do you build trust?
So right now, we in BitInstant version 1, you don't need to create an account with us. We just do basic OFAC checking, and you have to present ID at the store. Or if you're using Dawala, you have to work with them on KYC. But we have internal ways to be able to tell if you're trying to circumvent their limits, or if you're trying to do some fraud or do a chargeback or something. Hmm.
So you made an interesting comment, which I didn't understand, and you said that mining is not actually mining, it's auditing. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, like I was saying before, every second, a credit card transaction happens, and Visa has that central transaction server in a data center that they pay a lot of money, billions of dollars a year, to make it work. because you need that. Like, trust, PayPal is the same thing. That's how, you know, databases work. So with Bitcoin was that Satoshi said, what we're going to do is we're going to take this database that everyone can see, everyone can read it, and instead of keeping it on a server somewhere and having all the transactions be written on that database in a central server, let's give everyone a copy of the database. So everyone's going to download a copy of the database. But then you need a way for all new transactions to be written to this database. The problem is that because it's on everyone's computer, it requires a lot of computing resources to actually connect to every single one and to write to it. It's like file sharing. It takes a lot of resources. So Satoshi said, all right, what we're going to do is, and also don't forget, you need a way to check every single database to make sure that someone's not taking his bitcoins and double spending them. And that's a very, very big thing, is that double spending and arbitrary printing. So Satoshi said, all right, what I'm going to do is...
I love the way you say Satoshi said. This is like Buddha or something.
Yeah, he's a god figure to all of us.
and he's now worth $100 million, right?
He's probably worth a lot more than that.
For those who don't know, so Satoshi is like this mythical figure that's either a group or one person, which isn't publicly known yet, and I'm not going to ask Charlie, even if he does know who it is. He came up with the original concept. He has a lot of Bitcoin from the very beginning. He actually started doing mining himself, and so one post online recently suggested that Satoshi has about $100 million in Bitcoin just personally, and he's vanished. We don't really know who he is, and I think it's probably better that he stays that way.
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea and good move on his part. No, I mean, I know people who spend just months just analyzing Satoshi. I'm infatuated with him. I just read everything he writes. I'm like a super Satoshi believer.
But he's gone now, isn't he?
He's gone.
Yeah.
But I mean, just trying to understand why he created Bitcoin is still a big mystery. He thought of everything, any question anyone's going to ever have, he thought of, and just around governance, around power in Bitcoin, like how the miners have to rely on the developers, and the developers have to rely on the people, and the people have to rely on the miners, and everyone has to rely on each other, where if one person tries to screw one other person over, it won't work. The whole system would break down. So everyone has this like common goal to work together, and that no one has more power than one other person. There's no central point of failure in Bitcoin, which I think is really, really beautiful. But going back to what I was talking about with the database, so Satoshi said there needs to be a way for... We need to solve two problems, right, Satoshi said. We need to solve a problem one. We need massive amounts of computing power to be able to write to all these databases in real time as transactions are happening. Not only that, but we need a way to release money, to release bitcoins in an automated way, in a predictable scale, but not rewarding anyone for doing nothing. There needs to be like a reason for these people to get these bitcoins. So he solved that with the system of mining. So what miners do essentially is anyone can mine. Your laptop won't really do much because the amount of bitcoins that you'll be getting is your computing power of your computer relative to the whole network. So if your computer is 1% of the whole network, you'll get 1% of the new bitcoins that come into it. And essentially what your computer is doing is it's every 10 minutes or so, or 15 minutes sometimes, the blockchain takes all the transactions that happened in those 15 minutes, it wraps it up into a block, and puts it into the mining pools for auditing, and then all the miners try to solve this like really, really, really hard math problem that takes a really long time, about like 15-20 minutes. And while they're doing that, they're taking all these transactions and they're broadcasting it to the whole network. And once it's written and confirmed, the block becomes confirmed, and then whoever found the block, and I say found with quotations, is the one, whichever miner is the one who actually gets the bitcoins.
So one of the ideas that is being proposed is a currency, like let's say if Bitcoin breaks, and we could have a currency without mining. And I mean, there's something like in 10 or 20 years, even with Bitcoin as it is now, mining will become redundant because we'll have mined the whole thing. So how does that all work? How does that all fit together?
So I think there are two questions there, but I want to answer the second one first. Mining will not become redundant because what happens is that once there's no incentive for new coins to be mined, miners need to make money another way, because transactions still need to be audited, and it's very important that they do. These guys are like the soldiers for Bitcoin. So taking a step back here, all Bitcoin transactions are free, but you do have the opportunity to add a transaction fee onto it. By doing so, miners are incentivized to take your transaction and audit it first. So if you attach even a few cents to it, your transaction could be put into the next block, or if you don't attach a transaction fee, it could take a day or two for it to have one confirmation. So if I'm selling a car or a house, I want it to be confirmed as fast as possible. So I'm going to add 10, 15 bucks, and then a miner will want to put it in. So the hope is that as the reward for Bitcoin gets smaller and smaller every 4 years, so it went from 50 bitcoins to 25 bitcoins, and then it'll go to 12 and a half. By the time it reaches that zero point, the size of the Bitcoin economy itself will be big enough where people want to put transaction fees, and 25 bitcoins in a block is nothing, and that'll overtake it. Satoshi thought of all of these things before. He knew that mining would become redundant and there'd still be a need to incentivize miners. And we're already seeing that already. People are attaching transaction fees. It takes, I mean, Mt. Gox, if you try to withdraw bitcoins from Mt. Gox and you don't click the add transaction fee, Mt. Gox, there's a warning message. It says, are you sure you want to send this transaction without adding a fee to it? It may take a few days for it to get confirmed. So there's that. And then the first thing you asked, look, I think Bitcoin is three things, right? Bitcoin is a currency and it's a payment system. But more importantly, it's a protocol and it's a
Right.
system. It's
It's
a
a
system.
platform.
Exactly. It's a platform like HTTP or Voice over IP.
And
Now,
that's
voice.
why there's Namecoin, which is for adding DNS on top of Bitcoin, which is pretty
Exactly.
astounding.
Exactly. So you have like Voice over IP and HTTP that are exactly like Bitcoin. But Voice over IP is a protocol that billions of people rely on every day that's never been hacked. For the same reason Bitcoin's never been hacked. It's open source, it's worldwide, anyone could be involved in it. Same thing with, well, not HTTP really. But at the same time, I think Bitcoin as an idea is what's the most valuable. The idea of a virtual currency or a payment system and a currency that's not controlled, issued, or regulated by any state, government, or corporation, that whole idea is what really makes Bitcoin, I think, worth billions of dollars. So Bitcoin, as we see it now, may in fact fail. And a lot of really true believers of Bitcoin are really not afraid to say it, that there is a chance Bitcoin is flawed and there's a problem with it and it could fail. But then you'll have Bitcoin 2.0, or you'll have Namecoin, or Litecoin, or Ripple. I mean, I love the Ripple guys, and I think they're doing a great job, and I love their concept, even though I don't fully understand it. So I think it's like the whole idea of a virtual currency is what's like, it's the, I see Bitcoin as like the largest socioeconomic experiment the world has ever seen. Because you're taking all of these people around the world who before Bitcoin had no interest in each other, no common goal, nothing. And now we're taking all of these people, millions of people today, that are all involved in this experiment together, and just the data and the analysis of how people like control their money, are responsible for their money, act with Bitcoin, all of that data and like analysis is just amazing. And you could really use all of that to write theses and to create models and to try to learn how people react in economics.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk more about that, but I'd actually rather not discuss that in an interview. No, I mean, because I know how gigantic the implications are. I've lived outside the US for a long time, but I would rather not highlight that stuff. I'd
Thank you.
prefer.
But thank you for acknowledging it because a lot of people don't.
Oh, to me, that's the
That's the
obvious
real
thing. But
value.
so I'd rather the less we highlight that, I think the better. I prefer the other stuff, at least for public conversation.
Sure.
Tell me about, so Ripple to me is very interesting, and the reason why is I'm starting to look at some of these things as maybe as a two-step algorithm. The first is that we have some way of things connecting on the internet as peer-to-peer. And so two examples of that is before Google came along, we just had lots of websites and users and websites. The web is essentially a peer-to-peer system. And another example is Facebook. As people were connecting together, I guess we could say, with GeoCities crappy websites or whatever. So that's a peer-to-peer system, which is, again, similar to Bitcoin. On top of that, what made Google work was, because we end up with these trust issues, is this concept of a distributed trust network. And so that's where Google uses backlinks so that sites can link to other sites and so on. And that was a profound innovation when Google came along, and it's still held. I mean, I know that they tweak their algorithm a lot, but it's gotten them a long way. Facebook's the same. Facebook is a peer-to-peer, and then it's a distributed trust network built on top of that. So what's interesting is that Ripple is the same concept in the Bitcoin world. Bitcoin is the peer-to-peer platform, and then Ripple is a distributed trust network built on top of that. And it seems I spent a lot of time thinking about it, because it seems like it would be the concept of Ripple is that we have to effectively rate all of our friends and say how much we're willing to extend credit to them, and that's how Ripple works. That sounds horribly annoying, and it's the sort of thing where if you think of everybody that you know and how do you rate them, and you know, then do they get pissed off because you're not willing to give someone more credit and all of that stuff. But that's what's behind Ripple. And so I was initially very negative on it, but then seeing that it's worked for the same concept is applied for Google and Facebook and a lot of other things, this peer-to-peer then with distributed trust network on top, says to me that maybe there is something in Ripple on it. And so I'm curious to your thoughts.
No, I agree totally, and I really felt the same way for a long time. I mean, I used to be a big, not a fan of Ripple whatsoever. Fast forward now, Chris Larson and his team are unbelievable people. They have a rock solid team of people, and the whole concept is just truly genius. And the thing is, Ripple existed before they got involved. Ripple was something else. Ripple was just I forget exactly what it was, but it was it was basically what it is now without Bitcoin.
It was a bunch of hippies getting together saying how they wanted things to work. I think that's what.
Yeah, I guess that. So it was really cool. And how he applied it to money, I think, also is just novel and should work. What I see in Ripple that I didn't see was that Ripple gives the ability for lending in Bitcoin.
Right.
Because Bitcoin itself, it's like with banks are allowed to lend a certain amount of money based on how much they have, and that's how money is put into circulation. With Bitcoin is that it's a little bit different. It's very different. Money's put into circulation a different way, and so there's not much of an incentive to lend, just because you have to lend with money that you have, not with made up money like banks are allowed to do. But with Ripple, it gives the ability to lend people money without having to trust someone who walks in your door just like randomly, because Bitcoin's irreversible. So if you lend someone money, there's just so much you can do to get that back. With Ripple, there's kind of like this trust network set up, and I really like it. But I think it's also like too early to tell. It needs a lot more adoption and everything to see. But the main point is that Ripple is not a competitor to Bitcoin.
No,
rather
it's an additional layer.
Exactly. It's extremely complementary, to the point where Ripple and Bitcoin companies have mutual investors, and there are people from the Ripple team that are invested in other Bitcoin companies. So it's just like, it's a really, really nice system that was built on top of it.
And with all of these things, it comes down to how does it perform when it gets out in the wild. And we're there with Bitcoin, at least in the early stages, and we don't know where Ripple will go. But distributed trust networks is an important concept on the internet, and so it wouldn't surprise me if what they end up doing works.
Yeah, I think it could be cool infrastructure for like banks to use.
Yeah, I mean, for a while. I think we can't even guess at how far it could go. We've talked a lot. Do you have some things that you want to tell us which we haven't covered?
Oh, I think we covered a lot of different things. I'm really happy with the interview.
Great. Well, Charlie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.